Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
I'm one of HRN's interns, Nina Medvinskaya, with a preview of the next episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week's topic? The marriage of food and danger. Sometimes, danger lurks in the food that we eat.
So instead of saying what is poisonous, I'd rather say what's not, because it's literally just the flesh and the fins.
Food poisoning doesn't just threaten our bodies, but it endangers our environment as well.
The emissions of JBS, combined with the other top five meat companies, exceed the annual emissions of Exxon, Shell, or BP.
For more, tune into this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to Why Food? This is your co-host, Jenny Dorsey.
And I'm Ethan Frisch.
Today we have Eric Kim, who is the senior editor at Food 52. If you haven't been on Food 52, you should definitely go take a look. They're a digital food media publication. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited.
So, Eric, tell us what you do. Tell us about your day-to-day.
My day-to-day? I get in. I stumble in, usually, with a coffee. We have a Chemex station over in the corner. And I make some coffee. I have some coffee, and then I sit at my desk and usually answer some emails. But my job is mostly editing, other people, contributors, my team, editors under me, and I also I love writing once in a while. So I have a weekly column where I write about cooking for one. That's been a lot of fun.
We had Alex Miasi from Gastro Obscura 2 weeks ago,
yeah.
On the show, and he talked about how his writing editing mix. Can you talk about your transition from writing more to editing more?
Yeah, for sure. I feel like I've been editing more than writing professionally, actually, but that's meant that I find that writing professionally is actually a lot harder than editing. Or I think it's a personality thing. I'm not able to churn out as many words as some of the very talented staff writers at Food 52. So I love editing, and I love helping people tell their stories. But when I do write, it's usually because I have something to say or a recipe, a delicious thing I want to talk about.
So. And you came from a different style of writing and a different style of reading. tell us about what you did before food writing.
Yeah, for sure. Before food, I was in academia. I loved school so much, and I loved writing essays about novels, and so I was good at school, so I kept doing it. and I started a PhD program at Columbia. It was in the English and Comparative Literature department, and it was a lot of fun. I loved being a student, but there was a moment when I had trouble imagining the end game of it, and I was watching a lot of academics that I looked up to that who inspired me during that whole journey. I watched them like end up in other careers and live these really beautiful, happy lives. So, because I think the one, I won't beat around the bush, the one thing about academia is that unless you really get that tenured track job at the end, which is a very rare thing, it's such a difficult life to live. I think it's really hard to find a job, but it's also just, it's draining. You're just always you're always working, and you're always reading, writing, grading essays. It was just this constant, you had to be on, 24/7, and I thought that was very difficult, and ultimately wasn't as rewarding in the end as I thought it would be.
Were you doing research as well?
Oh yeah, research. That's the one thing about academia. I was trying to become an English professor, and there are a lot of aspects to that job that are so, exciting for people. I think that's why people go into academia, because you get to teach. You get summers off usually. But you also have to churn out books, and you have to do research, and I still love all of that. I think that's why I love being an editor so much right now, because of the churning out of content and stories. And that's a really beautiful thing to do if you're a writer. And I won't call myself an artist, but I feel like it's the same impulse of like putting ideas out there. That's mm-hmm. something that is very important to my mental health, I realized. Basically being able to put out creativity. And I think with academia, though, there's a lot of sitting on your hands and waiting around. And when it comes to the day-to-day, there's a lot of performance that has to happen. It's a lot of politics within departments. And I was so young when I was in academia, and I wasn't good at talking in front of these older professors who were really scary, I thought. And I hadn't figured that out yet, but I loved teaching. So you can tell how like complicated I still like feel like I'm getting over the trauma, but there were aspects of it that I loved and that were so learning, but aspects that were very difficult to sustain. I think that was the point.
And you were doing some food-related stuff on the side when you were academia.
Yeah, I was. I think it's because I was trying to find an outlet. So I'll just say, like, in the third year of a PhD program, it's usually the orals year, and I struggled with that year so much because you become a hermit. I read about, like, how much I love being a hermit, but this is, like, not the good kind, I think. You truly don't have time. I saved so much money that year because I just like never went out and never like ate food. And but you have to stay in your home and read. You have to read like 100 books, over the course of the year. And I was teaching like two classes. That was like the relief. I loved teaching. I still do. But it was a lot of just ingesting and things going into your brain, but nothing coming out until the end of the year when there was like an exam. And I struggle with that so much, and I realized the last few years, I think the one thing that I realized I really need is to put out words and to just, I don't know, I was trying to figure out a way to say this without it being cheesy, but...
It's all right, it's a food podcast. Cheesy is where we live.
Yeah.
Cheese, yes, I do love cheese.
Nice.
But you know, like putting out art, if you're an artist or you're a narcissist, I always feel like if you're a writer, there must be some ego there for you to be a writer or to call yourself a writer. And I do call myself a writer. I think it's the one thing that I've ever been remotely good at, and I'm bad at a lot of other things, but writing is something that I've always felt confident in ever since I was little. The SATs, you know, that was like my high score. Anyway, I think writing is like my way of kind of like an artist needs to, you know, paint or whatever. I think my brother's actually an artist. I think there's a, when you're a creative person, putting, like, making things, like, just tangible objects, essays, articles, anything, that's a really important thing for me to feel fulfilled and to feel like a satisfied human being. And that was something that you don't necessarily get all the time when you're a professor, because, you know, it's a lot of other things. It's a lot of dealing with... It's a lot of dealing with other things. And I was freelancing on the side, especially during the summer. So I really needed, I had a stipend through the year, but in the summer, they just kind of let you go. And most people just go back to their parents' house, I think, and like just chill out there and save money. And you like sublet your New York apartment. But I always worked at Food Network. I interned there when I was in college, and I met so many intelligent, like beautiful people there. These strong women who were my bosses, and those people, I loved working for them. And I think that was they inspired me and showed me like that there's this other life. These very intelligent literary women, who we're all English majors. That's like the cool thing about. I realized, oh, there's another kind of English major. You don't have to become a professor. You can become this editor, food writer, something else, and these people were happy, and I was like, how do I do that? How do I be happy? Yeah.
I think one of the challenges that a lot of early stage writers or aspiring writers struggle with is the question of audience. Who are you writing for? Is anybody reading anything that you're writing? Is it worth writing, or where's the incentive to write if you know that not a lot of people are going to read it?
Yeah.
How did you, in the early days of becoming a food writer, how did you grapple with that?
Yeah, for sure. I do want to say, just to like harp on the narcissism or the egotism of a food writer, which I feel like we all are. But I Instagram is the thing that really helped me kind of satisfy that part of my brain. Yeah, I guess I did freelance, but I also, Instagram was the daily thing that I did, which is I would cook this meal. I talked about like how hard it was to leave the house, so but I would have to cook, and I watched a lot of Nigella Lawson on YouTube, and so I tried a lot of her recipes because they were so easy, and but as I did that, I would put them on Instagram, and I would write about them, and Instagram is this beautiful thing. It's this small kind of space in which you can say what you want. I used that as much of that space as I could. I think eventually there was no cap. There's definitely a cap.
There's a cap. I've reached 2,200 characters,
which is a lot. It's a lot. But I think practicing, I realized that it was a great opportunity to like tell a story very quickly, and kind of tell a beginning, middle, and end, and end with a hook. And usually I wanted to make people cry. That was something that was always a goal of mine.
Why did you?
Yeah, what does that mean? What were these stories that were?
These stories. You know, whether it was something I was going through or something really sweet that happened to me. I love writing about sweet moments of life. And Instagram's like the snapshot, but there's the opportunity, that space to like write a tiny little snippet that tells a story. And I love when stories, especially, I found that these stories ended up being about food because, you know, whether it wasn't just my family, but like out in the world, things would happen to me. And like I've written about Maine, for instance. And when I went to Maine, all these really serendipitous things happened to me. I won't go into them here. I feel like it's like, for instance, strangers, you know, saying something very kind to you in a moment where you really needed it. That happened to me once, my first time going to Maine. And I think how to put that into writing, into an Instagram caption, that was kind of, you know, you have this beautiful photo, but I wanted people to know the experience, like the beautiful thing that happened off camera. And Instagram's perfect for that. And it's a short space and you say it. And yeah, and I loved practicing like that. And also with recipes, like when I was starting to develop recipes for a food blog I was doing on the side during, you know, school, it was a great way to, I realized that it was basically a recipe head note. That's kind of what an Instagram caption is. I think it's a recipe head note. And
what's a recipe head note?
Oh, a recipe head note is it's the thing at the beginning of the recipe that tells you the story. And there's like that joke that you know, sometimes it's too long, and you have to wade through that very long story.
Scroll through all the photos, and then
yeah. And then I feel like, was it the New Yorker? They kind of made fun of that. And at the end, there was no recipe. The New Yorker does a lot of parodies, but anyway, that was so funny. But yeah, it made me practice how to tell the story of the recipe very quickly, and then you know, link in bio, and then people go to your profile. I don't think anyone actually does that, but it made me practice this thing that I would end up doing, you know, professionally. So
since you mentioned Nigella Lawson, there was a development to that story pretty recently, right? Tell us.
A few things happened. It happened very slowly, actually.
The best kind of story.
best kind of story. Yeah. So, you know, when I quit school eventually, and I started working for one of my old bosses, whom I loved, at Food Network. And while I was there, you have this like cubicle. It's actually like the cubicle has like a bad word, like a rep, it has a bad rep. But it's actually the cubicle there. It was a safe haven for me. It was a nest. I was fleeing this terrible, dark past life of academia. but it, you know, you can decorate it. And there's a lot of space for you to put up decorations. And so I was like, what do I put up here? So I made mine London themed. And I had a lot of pictures of Nigella on the walls. And she's very much a reason why I went into food and thought it was, you know, a possibility at all. Because the way she writes and talks about food, it's way more than the food. It's always about culture. It's always about personal narrative. And anyway, my cube is decorated with Nigella stuff. You're going to be sorry that you got me into talking about Nigella, because this can take forever. But, you know, eventually when I left for Food 52, I accepted the job, but they had this like Nigella was cooking in their kitchen for like this event, for her last book, At My Table. And I, you know, I went to the event and I got to meet her. And it was like, it was in the Food 52 offices. So it was just so emotional for me. Like, I'll probably cry just talking about it. But it was like starting this new career, or starting this new job, and also getting to meet Nigella in the new job, you know, the new space of the job. And it was all so much happening at once. And I like started talking to her and I was like, oh, I came from Food Network. Your face is all over my walls in that cubicle. And she joked that it was like creepy. And then quickly I just like started crying. Like I couldn't like stop because I started saying like, you mean you've meant so much to me. It's really hard to like explain to your hero. Like mm-hmm. that's such a, I hate that word, but it, I don't know, it's hard to tell that person like everything that they've meant to you and the like the career changes that have happened because of that person. But she was I like cried in front of her and then we like left it off and then a few weeks later I started the job and I ended up writing this essay about how much she's helped me. And it was kind of like my way of redeeming that that really awkward like personal exchange I had with her.
I don't think it was awkward.
She was really nice about it. But you know, and I wanted to do it justice. I was like, there's a story here. There's a reason. Like she taught me so many. She taught me basically to take care of myself. Like that's what her show's about in her books. And it was for her book How to Eat. It went through a 20th anniversary edition this year. And so I kind of just wrote about academia actually and how dark and twisty that time of my life was and how depressed I was and how she taught me to. It was cooking and, you know, taking care of yourself. And those are the kind of the lessons I took from her. And then I was talking to her PR, her publicist, because I like just needed a picture of her or something. And she ended up sending the essay to Nigella and Nigella emailed me directly. There was one moment where I had the, my boss was in front of me, Suzanne, and she was like saying something to me, but that it just came up in my email. It said Nigella. I was like, what the? And I just like started like crying, and then I don't know. And I was like, I'm so sorry, but I can't hear anything you're saying right now because this thing just happened. And she just said that the essay meant a lot to her, and she was like, yeah,
that's wonderful.
Why?
I can't talk about Nigella without crying. She's just, yeah, she's just, it was cool. It was just cool to get an email from her.
What do you feel like she's, what's the standard that she's set for you or how do you feel her style and her values and her writing have affected your work?
Right. Well, I think it's the style of her writing. It's rigorous. I think people just know her as a TV personality, and she's very good at that, which I appreciate. I think that's so important to be able to translate food, no matter how complicated or like how complexly you write about it. I think what she does is she's able to translate those stories, those contexts around the food. She goes in depth in her books. Like people, I don't know if people realize that, but like one of my favorite books of hers is Feast, and she goes into the etymology, the histories. Anyway, I could talk about this forever.
Well, tell us how it connects to your work. How have you tried to do that?
Yeah,
yourself?
For sure. That's actually so. Reading her made me realize, oh, there's a way to kind of do this academic thing. Like I love academia for the intellectual like. Work and the contextualization that it does around novels, because novels are culture, and you can pick up a book and everything about that book, its history, its publishing history, like the writer who wrote it, what the time they lived in, it says a lot about culture and context. And I've realized that she was able to do that with recipes, and mm-hmm. she wrote academically about food, and I was like, oh, this is cool. This is something that's actually a career. And and I wanted to do that as well.
What are some of the pieces that you've edited or written at Food 52 you think that does a good job of contextualizing what you care about now?
Yeah, a lot of things. I think whenever something happens, in current events, like for instance, the travel ban. When that happened, I have this Persian writer. She wanted to write about what that meant to her and the consequences of that ban on her family not mm-hmm. being able to visit her in America anymore, and she was going through that, and being an editor on that was really really rewarding, because you're able to help someone tell their story. Because it's so immediate, it means, you know, there's a zucchini stew at the end of the story, because mm-hmm. it's, you know, about her mother and memories of cooking that. But ultimately, it's like a good example of, you know, how food, we don't just live in vacuums. It's food is always going to be a way to talk about things that are happening right now. You know, I love history and I love writing about history, but history means nothing if you're not, you know, providing it in the context of the present. So
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in 2 minutes with Eric Kim, who's a senior editor at Food 52. Stay tuned.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit Korin.com.
And we're back with Eric Kim, senior editor of Food 52, and we spent our break talking about his Nigella story
in more detail.
Yeah, there are things I needed to say.
But the reason that I brought it up is because I think you, unlike the other writers or journalists we've had on this show, but I think unique among food writers writ large, is that you've done exceptionally to tying your personal story in with your food writing and, mm-hmm. and recipes that represent moments or represent sentiments or represent interactions that you've had with people close to you. And I love your column, Table for One. Is that
thank
what
you.
Called?
Thanks so much. Yeah.
Where you take an idea that normally is seen as a sad, sorry, cooking for yourself is not something that's widely celebrated, but obviously something that everybody does. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you've turned it into this celebration of, I don't know, family and background. So tell us, I don't know what I'm asking. Tell us.
Just talk more about,
that. I can totally speak to that. Actually, like, it's been a lovely kind of marker for the week, like, you know, once a week or however, you know, whenever I can get to it. It's kind of my way of, like, sitting down and thinking about what I want to say that week. And it's been so rewarding because, you know, my editors at Food 52 are so encouraging, and they kind of they were like, you know, just try it, just go for it. And so one day we just put it on the calendar. And I wrote I had this, you know, inkling that, you know, I think it was more about like curiosity. I wanted to know what people cook when no one's watching. That was like the first one. And it got like 100 comments and all these people telling really funny stories about like, oh, when I'm alone, I eat this. And I loved hearing about that. I don't know. A lot of them are really funny. Some of them are like sad. Some of them are, and there's such a breadth of stories that happen when you're alone at the table. And no one really, you don't talk about those stories because it's just you, and food is often cast as like a family thing, and like mm-hmm. you know, family is very important, of course, like always. But there are other kinds of stories, and this column has let me explore that. And I think "explore" is like an important word, because I started it and I was like, I don't really know what it was gonna be. You know, sometimes it is like a recipe for one. It's like a proper like single serving dish or a meal. But I found that, you know, week to week, I was able to kind of experiment. And when Thanksgiving happened, I had a Thanksgiving table for one, and I was like, what am I going to say about Thanksgiving? And I was feeling really sad at the time. I was really depressed because I had I won't go into it, but it was something happened over the weekend that that really upset me, and it meant that I was going to be spending Thanksgiving alone. And I love Thanksgiving so much, and I was writing about it, you know, for work. And you always write about it in the context of like family, like we said. Mm-hmm. But I was like, you know what though? Like my Thanksgiving is gonna be alone. Like I'm gonna be with my dog in my apartment. I want to write about that. I want to write about those feelings. And I published it, and I got like a nice response. Mostly, like I get a lot of responses on Instagram too. Like, you know, we have a comment section, but a lot of people follow over to the Instagram and they DM me, and that's kind of like a private way for them to talk to me. Mm-hmm. And that's something I love, because then, you know, they're able to share their stories in a very intimate, private way. The comment section can be performative sometimes, you know.
Yeah. But,
you know, and so all these other people who are like, yes, I'm spending Loansgiving too this mm-hmm. year. Mm-hmm. And it was like kind of supposed to be a joke of a word, but all these people were like, I have one user named White Antlers whom I love. I adore her. And she kind of was talking to me about, you know, why she's spending her Thanksgiving alone. It's because her wife, maybe it's not my story to tell, but she was kind of sharing these intimate details about her past. And it was very much like, wow, the people have all these stories that they can relate to. And I love the column because it's a way for like the people who are alone to reach out and to be like, oh, that's me too. I'm also alone. Mm-hmm. And then when you're like alone together, you're not alone anymore. Anyway,
I also want to talk about something you just said, is like, maybe it's not my story to tell.
Right.
I think there's a huge, that just that statement in the food world right now is really important, because yes. Who gets to tell whose stories?
Oof, that's so important. Yes. I think it comes up a lot, especially yeah. as an editor. I think the one thing about working at Food 52 that's been rewarding is the stories we get are very diverse, and they come from different cultures and backgrounds and politics and religions. And what happens is, you know, you're just the editor, so it's really satisfying to be able to give someone the byline or the platform to tell their story. And it's really valuable. It's really important to let them tell the story. And that's why, I don't know, I always try to commission as many people of color as I can. It's something that I've spoken publicly about. But I think it's important for the editor not to insert themselves too much, you know, in terms of the story, but to help that person tell the story in the clearest way. That's just style. It's like form. It's like, it's just like, that's just writing. But, you know, they're the ones with the story. And it's very rewarding for me to be able to help people tell their story. Yeah.
Do you, in telling your personal stories through food, do you feel like there's something intrinsic in food that lends itself to personal storytelling?
Oh yeah, for sure. That's a great statement and question. I think, so with academia, I guess like whenever I was writing about novels, and I wanted to say something about culture, it was always like this very esoteric thing, you know, and you like point to that one sentence and that's, I still like enjoy doing that. Sometimes I bring in like other food writing or, you know, other moments in journalism that help speak to the story I want to tell. But yeah, I think when there's food involved, that's the one thing that I realized about food writing. It was a way for me to rigorously talk about culture and context and politics, anything that needed to be said in a very concrete way. And it's not, and just knowing that, like, I don't mean this lightly, there's a recipe at the end a lot of the time. And so someone can go and cook that zucchini stew. That was always a very satisfying thing for me, coming from a profession where no one will ever read your book, if you publish like an academic book or even an article. With food writing, though, everyone eats, everyone cooks. Everything I'm saying right now feels like a cliche, but I also think food media has grown so much to include other disciplines. It's a multidisciplinary, profession or medium, and I think that's a beautiful thing because it means so many more people are listening and reading and ingesting. So it's a great opportunity to like say what you want to say.
When somebody cooks a recipe that's at the end of an article or a column that you've written,
yeah.
why are they doing it? What are they trying to accomplish? Is it just purely because the dish looks good and they want to taste it, or do you think there's something else happening?
That's a great question. I'd like to think it's because they want to feel my pain.
Talk about something so dark.
Share the pain.
Just kidding. No, I think it's because it looks delicious, or because like they want to try it. Usually, you know, this is like something I like doing. When I'm writing about something very difficult, like I've written about coming out to my parents once, I've written about my depression, and when you have a difficult like essay in our subject matter, it's really lovely to get to just spend one graph like talking about the dish, and really, you know, that's like, it's like a relief. It's relief for the reader and for the writer, and I think that's yeah, that's the chance for you to like kind of sell the dish. And at the end, when someone does cook it, it's really nice because, you know, I was joking about it before, but truly, like, if they cook it and it's, like, and the recipe works and it's delicious, they can also think about where it came from. And I think that's really beautiful.
How do you choose the dish?
I was about to say, yeah. How do you know this is the dish? I'm sure there's a lot of dishes that could potentially work in its place.
Interesting. Yeah. That's a great question. You know, ideas for articles always, you know, they come in different ways. I think the way we do it at 52, it's often the dish that comes first. Well, I don't know. They're not really separate. Like, I'm not going to talk about, like, when I was going through the Thanksgiving stuff, or the Lunsgiving stuff, I was making a sheet pan cornbread stuffing to bring to a Friendsgiving. And it made me think about how my actual Thanksgiving on Thursday would be spent alone. And I was like, you know, so I was thinking about that and I was making the stuffing. So, and the story was about the stuffing and I think what happens is like, I don't know, they're always kind of very related. There's a reason why I want to talk about the dish, but it's because like it's in, you know, that moment of like whatever's bigger has happened.
What was the recipe that came with your story of coming out to your parents?
Oh, right. That one was kimchi fried rice. That one's like, it's for a column called My Family Recipe at 52. And it's kind of our moment in the week to have a long form storytelling moment. And it's, you know, every time people are pitching me or I kind of like reach out to writers I know for this column, I'm kind of like, what is your desert island dish? What's your last meal on earth food? Because that dish always has the best story, I think. And mine has always been kimchi fried rice. And when I thought about like why it was, it was related to my mom, of course. And so like, I was like, what's the biggest thing that's happened to us? It was like coming out to them. It was very dramatic and there's a lot of things going on. And I thought it was a nice and very difficult opportunity to talk about my family and to talk about that dish specifically.
How do you think your voice has developed over this trajectory of coming from a non-food background where you were probably writing in certain styles or had to analyze and read things in a certain way to where you are now?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's funny because I was actually teaching writing and it's called University Writing at Columbia. I don't know if you ever had to take it. Anyway, it's like this, you have four different essays and they're you know, they're very in length and, you know, they're very whatever. But the last one is like, oh, this is the cute, 500 to 700 word one. And it's the op-ed, it's the article. And, you know, the assignment says to, you know, pitch it at the end of the year to publications, and you know the star students do get, you know, placed, but usually it's like it's kind of just our when I think about being taught how to teach that article, that last progression they called it, it was always just kind of like, oh, this is just the last one because you don't have time. But and I was teaching this thing that I didn't even know how to do. I didn't know that until I started journalism. And I started writing, for like, if you think about your phone screen, like, I think that kind of writing is very different than a really esoteric, long, 20-page, you know, academic essay. And it's like more line breaks, more, it's like all these things. And there's like space, actually with digital, there's, you know, fewer space limitations, but it made me realize, how to say things faster, which is something I still struggle with. But I think saying things faster on the page is something that benefits everyone. You know, it's like when you're reading something, but also when you're writing, it's nice to, it's kind of like, you know, what I was saying about being an editor, when you can help someone tell their story in the best way, that also means how to tell it in the clearest and most concise way. Mm. And so that's definitely something that's changed with my writing. You know, coming from academia, I learned on the job, I think. And also just ingesting, you know, other people's writing, Nigella's writing, realizing that there's, if you say it in a very concise, fast way. Also Instagram, actually. Instagram yeah. has that space limitation. And it, you know, it's on your phone. I actually edit on my phone a lot. Not just because I'm, like, scrambling to get to the office and I'm, like, on the train. But, like, I edit on my phone, which my managing editor thinks is crazy. But I do it because you just, like, notice more minutia and, like, details. And so I'm editing on my phone all the time because I notice more things, like little things, and it's kind of like my process. Edit on the page first, like, you know, in the doc on your computer, and then I edit on my phone.
When I'm doing my Instagram captions, I always edit on my phone to see how long it actually ends up and how long I can keep people on my page.
Yeah.
Always maxing out that character limit.
Yeah.
Nice. How do you feel like, and actually maybe Jenny, you have a thoughts on this also, I'm sure, but how do you feel like recounting a situation, an emotional situation, whether positive or negative, yeah. But I think I'm particularly thinking of the story of coming out, which was, I think, ultimately positive, but sounded pretty difficult from the way that you wrote about it. Yeah. How do you feel like recounting that moment through food changes the way that you interact with the food, the recipe that you're presenting? Does the act of observing the moment through your writing change the way that you remember it, or change the way that you engage with the recipe that's associated with
it? That's so interesting. Yeah, I think I feel like there are a few questions there. The first one about the story, I think no matter what, when you're recounting something, you're always going to try to make it prettier. And I feel like that's like kind of something really important about when you go through something that's kind of traumatic. And I found, you know, suffering depression all through, you know, a lot of my life, but especially in school and academia, I found that writing about, you know, on Instagram and like writing about these difficult moments and somehow creating this really beautiful, oh my God, and I don't mean to call my writing beautiful, but creating a work of art or like some kind of like object at the end where people can read it and cry and like, you know, respond to you and it lives and breathes on its own as like a positive thing, even if it's sad. I feel like that's a way to work through traumas. And I think when it comes to the recipe, I definitely will not eat kimchi fried rice and not think of this anymore, I think. But the essay I wrote, because I actually didn't show my parents. They don't know that it's out there. They don't know that a bunch of people from Atlanta read it and know about our personal lives. It's like, my parents don't read the internet, first of all. So it's also, I don't think they even know what I do. It's just kind of a thing. I think it's like an Asian parent thing.
Yeah, my parents really don't know what I do, so.
How do you explain? Yeah, it's really hard to explain. I just say that, I read about food. but this essay, it says a lot of, there are a lot of details in there that I feel like they'd be uncomfortable with the world, you know, seeing. Mm. But ultimately, that was also important for me to, it was a positive story and a positive message because the way they handled my coming out was in a very loving way. And I wanted to write about the reality of coming out as a gay Asian man because coming out to an Asian family is different. I really think it's different. And that was a beautiful thing about that essay. A bunch of gay Asian men and women kind of reached out to me and they were like, wow, thank you for putting this into words because this is what happened to me or this didn't happen to me. Or I feel like there's just more hurdles. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Not to diminish anyone's story ever, but I feel like, yeah, anyway.
There's a lot of expectations.
There are a lot of expectations. But yeah, I think I made kimchi fried rice for a boy who was over one night. And I thought about the essay and I'm like it's a dish that I never made for myself because I always sucked at it. And like my kimchi sucks and like my mom's kimchi is like the best. And you know, that's like the thing about mom food, like you can't recreate it because like it's always gonna be worse. So I always just like, you know, associated it with like when I went home and like, you know, I never wanted to tackle it because I wanted the real one. But after I had to develop this recipe and I had to like recreate it. And as I did it, and you know, talking to her on the phone, and like that's a classic story. You're on the phone with your mom trying to like figure out how they do this. And it took a few tries, but it was very interesting to me to be able to create some semblance of what that is in my own kitchen as an adult, and that was satisfying. And that's something that I ended up cooking for like a boy who was like over, and it felt like a full circle moment or something.
Why was that what you chose to make for your
did you tell him
date?
What
oh yeah. It's because I was developing the recipe, like I needed to make it to like give to the kitchen for them to photograph, and I was like, oh, I have to like figure this out. That's actually like kind of a big part of my job. I'm not a recipe developer like in my title, so, but I write about my recipes, so I have to go home and like, any cooking that I do these days, it's usually on the weekends, or if it's on weeknights, it's, I have to eat it and I live alone, so it's kind of like every cooking opportunity is usually for work. Not in a bad way, but like, because I usually only write about foods that I want to eat, so.
Did you tell him that the genesis of the...
Yeah, yeah. And actually, I shouldn't say this. Well...
Say.
He ended up writing the next one in the column. And it was kind of this really lovely, you know, short-lived, like, little thing. But it was a lovely way for us to kind of get to know each other. I'm sure there's a huge conflict of interest. I don't know. Maybe there isn't. I don't know. But it was... he also had a beautiful story about his family, and so I was like, you know, I'm writing this week. Do you want to write the next one? And he did, and it was beautiful and it was delicious.
In the last few minutes of the podcast, with other guests, we don't get quite so personal, but so we usually have this kind of short answer.
Well, we can do longer answers section, in our quick fire.
Right.
Oh, no.
So we're just going to throw a couple of fun questions at you.
Okay.
One question that we often ask is, what did you eat growing up? What are your iconic childhood meals? But maybe are there other dishes you want to talk about other than kimchi fried rice?
Ooh, anything that was like a stew, yeah. My mom makes this, she likes like white rice and a fried egg, soy sauce, sesame oil, nori, and kim, like roasted seaweed snack. That was like this thing that we ate a lot. So it's something I eat a lot now because it's so fast. And actually, when I asked the internets, what do you cook when no one's watching? There's this huge list. There's a huge section in that piece that's just rice and egg and like kimchi and spam. And like, it's so lovely. And not, yeah, it's like, I love when there are semblances or like similarities between childhood foods like habits in the kitchen, because it shows some kind of connection between the cultures, and I think that's really cool.
I made spam fried rice for the stuffing for Thanksgiving this year. Whoa. And everybody at the table had like a spam story, which I thought was really interesting. Oh, and spam. Kind of funny. Yeah.
Nice. What's your spam story?
My spams, I mean, I used to eat a lot of it growing up, and I had no idea. Yeah, like I would just slice them, and then I would like eat a jar or a can, I guess, by itself.
Yeah.
And I remember my grandparents always telling me like, it's so salty, it's so bad for you. And I'd be like, I don't care. And it was like my way of being defiant.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, my little personal.
Because I always thought it was like it's very like Korean people eat spam, but other Asians, I was never sure.
Yeah, I'm sure the Hawaiians eat a lot of spam, I don't know if other Chinese people eat a lot of spam.
Yeah, I never hear that story. That's cool.
But now I go for spam, low sodium.
Me,
I'm an adult.
I don't. Well, I don't do that because it's it has less fat. Well, no, really? I do grab it sometimes because I love the notion of a low sodium, but I think it has less fat too, so it doesn't crisp up the same. But you're so right. I would love for it to have less sodium.
Right.
But the same fat.
I could also just add more sodium later.
Yeah.
If you could develop one skill overnight, what would it be?
Oh my God. Ooh. I would love to be better at... Oh, that's so hard. I've always been... I'm actually like not a great public speaker. That's kind of something that was always difficult for me. Like growing up, and I think that's like a skill that's worth having forever, no matter what you do. And that's something I'd like to get better at.
What would you speak about?
I don't know. Whenever I've had the chance to like be on panels recently, and you have to like. Luckily, it's about food and things that you want to talk about. But I don't know if those opportunities come up. I feel like there's coaching that can happen, and if I ever watch back video or if I listen back to this, I'm gonna like hate it. But you know, I feel like there's a lot to learn with that.
Are there things that you think you would say? with your voice that you don't say in your writing, or are there ways that speaking publicly is different from writing publicly?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think as a writer, you get to, I'm just like obsessed about the details, and you get to be obsessed about the details, and I get to tell exactly how I want to tell it. Whereas with talking, you know, you never know what's going to happen.
We're going to ask you some weirdo question about Nigella, and the podcast is going to go off the rails.
No, yeah.
You can also see what people, how people are reacting, which can be really stressful.
Stressful, scary. Yeah.
The last time I spoke publicly, I had the lights on the stage where I like couldn't see anyone.
Yeah.
So there was like 100 people, but I couldn't see anyone. I felt very secure.
Oh,
like,
cool. Yes. Yeah, that's nice. That's a good
just
feeling.
Anytime you speak publicly, just ask somebody to shine a flashlight while you're talking.
That's a good tip. Thanks.
Eric, it's been such a pleasure having you join us.
I forgot I was on the radio.
Yeah, well, nobody's listening. It's just the three of us.
That's not true.
tell our listeners where they can find you and read your work.
Oh, yeah. Please visit food52.com and read all the gorgeous essays we put up there and cook all the recipes. And I'm also on Instagram at Eric Junho, J-O-O-N-H-O, which is my Korean name.
And if anybody is interested in learning writing from you, writing for you, how do they
Oh, yeah, they can pitch. They can pitch. It's pitches at food52.com. And tell us your story.
Any other tips for a pitch?
Any tips?
Everybody, we're going there.
Yes. Definitely. Definitely provide some headline options. Show us that how you see it being published on the site. That's really important. I think people pitch us stories that would never really fit on food52.com. Mm-hmm. If it's a good story though, we will always want to tell it. But if you just put a headline to it. Kind of put a name on it, it helps us kind of contextualize it and sell it better, because my job is to pitch it, you know, to my editors, so make it easier to do that by putting some headlines on it.
Awesome.
Well, you can always find us at Why Food Podcast on Instagram and Facebook, and if you have questions for Eric or nominations or just things you'd like to tell us in general, you can email us at whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org.
And if you have any questions for next week's guest, our final guest of this season, Chitra Agrawal, who's the co-founder of Brooklyn Deli, let us know. Email us, send us messages on Instagram, and we'll make sure to ask her those questions. You can find me via my spice company, at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram, burlapandbarrel.com.
And I'm at Chef Jenny Dorsey. And thank you again for listening, and thank you to our wonderful artist who does our theme song,
Blind by the Red Crickets. And our awesome engineer, Matt Patterson. Join us next week for the last episode of the season.
Next year, Heritage Radio Network is turning 10. For the last decade, we've been committed to bringing listeners around the world the very best in food radio for free. Our small staff and incredible network of hosts work hard so that listeners can tune in each week to hear the important conversations in food policy, stay on the cutting edge of cocktail culture, and hear the latest updates in food tech. But there is no HRN without the support of listeners like you. Become a member of Heritage Radio Network today and help HRN get a strong start to our second decade. Choose from exclusive member gifts and stay in the loop on discounts to upcoming events. There's no better time to show your support. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and wish HRN a happy birthday.